You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me back.
Okay, we're rolling.
Okay.
And we're on section 57 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event. And we're not going to do any small talk.
Yeah. Because I have a cold.
You have a bit of a cold. And plus, we've been listening to some podcasts and we always skip right over the
small talk. I know. It's so annoying.
So, okay.
I think you called someone like, you were like, Grandpa, we don't want to hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I did.
But the guy was like totally acting like...
Yeah, I don't know. And no small talk.
Okay, sorry.
So we're going to dive right in.
Go ahead.
We're on section 57, page 96.
57, the history of being and the abandonment by being. The abandonment by being is the ground and thereby at the same time the more original determination of the essence of that which Nietzsche was the first to recognize as nihilism. Yet how little did he and all his power succeed in compelling Western Dasein to meditate on nihilism. Accordingly, the hope is even less that our era might summon up the will to know the ground of nihilism. Or is this knowledge first supposed to clarify the fact of nihilism? The abandonment by being determines a unique era in the history of the truth of being. It is the era of being of the long duration in which truth hesitates to put its essence into clarity. The time of the danger that every essential decision passes by. The time of the renunciation of the battle over measures. Decisionlessness as the realm of the unboundedness of machinations, where size spreads to the monstrous proportions of the gigantic and the transparency of what is empty passes for clarity. The long hesitation of truth and decisions is a withholding of the shortest path and of the greatest moments. In this era, beings, that which we call the actual life values, are disappropriated of being. The abandonment by being is cloaked in the increasing authority of calculation, speed, and the claim of the massive. The obstinately distorted essence of the abandonment by being is hidden away under this cloak, and it makes the abandonment unassailable.
And we're done.
Yeah.
I can't remember if he's mentioned nihilism already in the book yet.
I think he has, like, briefly.
Yeah, but I think what's interesting about...
one of the million things interesting about the book is that he does try to instigate Western Dasein to meditate on nihilism and have a more profound understanding of what is meant by nihilism than what has come to be meant by nihilism. It's nihilism has, in a sense, been politicized or moralized, and when we hear nihilist, we think someone who doesn't believe in anything, is probably amoral, is very cynical, undercuts any authority of institutions or of rules or of methods of approval and of action. So, but Nietzsche had a much different idea of what nihilism was. Heidegger doesn't get too much into it here, although he kind of does. But I mean, I think, you know, this first paragraph is like, you know, the abandonment by being is the ground and the determination of the essence of what Nietzsche recognized as nihilism. Mm-hmm. So the abandonment by being and nihilism are related as ground to effect. And but Heidegger says that didn't result in everybody meditating on nihilism at all. The abandonment by being determines a unique error in the history of the era in the history of the truth of Bang. So we're in this era now. It is the era of Bang, of the long duration in which truth hesitates to put its essence into clarity. The time of the danger that every essential decision passes by, the time of the renunciation, of the battle over measures. I'm a little unclear what he means by the time of the renunciation of the battle over measures. The time of the danger that every essential decision passes by. The time of the renunciation of the battle over measures. He's mentioned that before. Hmm. But it's strange because I feel like what he usually seems to be harping on about is that the battle over measures is very much what our era is committed to. That we just are battling over measures, and yet here it's a time of the renunciation of the battle over measures. So I'm not sure about that. Maybe we'll get back to it. Decisionlessness is the realm of the unboundedness of machinations. I think that's pretty clear, where size spreads to the monstrous proportions of the gigantic, and the transparency of what is empty passes for clarity. The long hesitation of truth and decisions is a withholding of the shortest path and the greatest moments in this era. Beings, actual life values, are disappropriated by Bang, so they're severed from Bang. The abandonment by being is cloaked in the increasing authority of calculation, speed, and the claim of the massive. All right, I don't know. To me, that's just like the internet. The obstinately distorted essence of the abandonment by being is hidden away under this cloak, and it makes the abandonment.
I don't think it is the internet.
What do you think it is?
I think, well, he's about to talk about it at length.
Oh, jeez.
But I don't think really like...
Yeah, no, I don't think he's kind of saying the internet. But.
Yeah, but it does sound like the internet, a shorthand for it. Kind of, or not shorthand.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just technology or...
Yeah.
Well, he's going to talk a lot about
it. Yeah.
I do want to say on the note of the massive, I put up a TikTok the other day that people generally seemed to like, and it was a little bit about how identities tend to, well, that identities do form a kind of subliminal conduit whereby one becomes massively invaded by universal feelings. And the example I used was when you're sitting there and you're saying, I am stressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you end up kind of actually feeling is, I am stress.
Mm.
And that identification with the general experience of stress and all its many global informational affective connections makes the experience of being stressed so much more overwhelming. And I think it's a little bit about, you know, the monstrous proportions of the gigantic here in that, you know, because identity, in a sense, hooks you into a general definitional, beyond your control space of meaning and causation, that though you're saying something like, I am stressed or I am anxious, you really becomes, I am anxiety and I am stress.
Yeah.
And that means you're feeling all the stress, everyone's anxiety. You're feeling anxiety en masse.
Mm-hmm.
And not just your own particular anxiety, but it's coming. I don't know. I guess an example, I would say it's like, it's kind of flowing into you through the subliminal channels that identity enables.
Yeah, totally.
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
So that reminds me of this emphasis on the massive
projection and the idea that once you say I am stress, or once you say I am stress or I am anxiety, then you're suddenly thinking, like you said, about all the different things and all the different potential problems.
Everything
with
everyone
that.
Said about anxiety, right. Everyone who is anxious, all the solutions, all the
right.
So why don't we just maybe start reading section 58?
Yeah.
See what he has to say about calculation, speed, and the claim of the massive.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
58. The three ways the abandonment by being cloaks itself, what they are and how they appear. 1. Calculation. First placed in power through the machinations of technology, which are epistemologically grounded in mathematics. Here, unclear anticipation in rules and guiding principles, hence the certainty of governing and of planning. The experiment, without questioning, one makes it through some way or other. Nothing impossible. One is certain of beings. The question of the essence of truth is no longer needed. Everything has to conform to the current state of calculation. On that basis, the priority of organization, renunciation of a freely developing change from the ground up. Here, the incalculable is merely that which has not yet been mastered in calculation, but which in principle will also be incorporated someday. Therefore, in no way is anything outside all calculation. In sentimental moments, when indeed are not...
Which indeed?
Yeah. In sentimental moments, which indeed are not seldom under the domination of calculation, there is concern over destiny and providence, but never such that from what is thus appealed to, a formative power could emerge and could manifest the mania for calculation in its proper limits. Calculation is meant here as a basic law of comportment, not as the mere deliberation or even the cleverness of an individual act. These later pertain to all human proceedings.
Yeah, what do you think of that? There's a lot in there.
Yeah, there is.
Calculation was put into power by technology, which is epistemologically grounded in mathematics. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, technology is, in a sense, mathematics realized. Here, in this world of mathematics realized, unclear anticipation in rules and guiding principles, hence the certainty of governing and of planning, the experiment. Yeah, without questioning, one makes it through some way or other. In other words, you just kind of go along with the ride. Nothing impossible, one is certain of beings. So there's just beings all around, though, you know, as Heidegger has pointed out a lot, you're not really thinking about their being. The question of the essence of truth is no longer needed. Nobody really cares about the essence of truth. Mm-hmm. Everything has to conform to the current state of calculation. Mm-hmm. On that basis, the priority of organization, renunciation of a freely developing change from the ground up. So the organization is the priority, and we must renounce any freely developing change from the ground up. Here, the incalculable is merely that which has not yet been mastered in calculation, but which in principle will also be incorporated someday. therefore in no way as anything outside all calculation, because it will be swallowed up sooner or later. In sentimental moments, which indeed are not seldom under the domination of calculation, there is concern. So in moments where you're kind of feeling outside the calculation, you get concerned over destiny and providence, meaning like where are we going and what is God's plan for us? But never such that from what is thus appealed to, a formative power could emerge and could manifest the mania for calculation in its proper limits. Meaning, we might in sentimental moments think about destiny and providence, but it never really generates an urge in us to place calculation into some kind of limited space and not live our entire lives through calculation. Calculation is meant here as a basic law of comportment. So it's a way to behave, not as the mere deliberation or even the cleverness of an individual act. So it's not just deliberating over things or singular clever behaviors by individuals. Rather, it's a large scale basic law of comportment. I don't know. I think about liberalism when I read this. I mean,
yeah.
Basically, I kind of think about liberalism and its reaction to anything that doesn't abide by its basic laws of comportment.
Yeah.
You know, I think a little bit about right now what's going on between, like, say, the desire to dismantle the deep state and the bureaucracy. Uh-huh. And the kind of reaction to that, which is that's insane, right?
Yeah.
That's unacceptable, that's kind of anarchy.
Yeah.
And if you track that through here, you can see that, you know, the bureaucracy, the liberal bureaucracy and deep state is the machination of technology. It's mathematics, it's epistemology, it's a subliminal, and it's an underground
certainty of governing and planning.
Yeah, exactly. It's a secret. It's how the world is run. It's rules and guiding principles. It's a certainty of governing and of planning. There's no questioning it. You're just supposed to sort of make it through. And it's not a question of whether it's actually achieving truth or results, because that's not needed anymore. It just is. Everything has to conform to its current calculations, like its calculations are correct, and to question them is completely unacceptable. The priority of organization, right?
Yeah.
And it's important that we renounce any freely developing change from the ground up. I mean, that's why people are going insane with Trump dismantling the deep state, because they are completely against freely developing change from the ground up.
Yeah.
Like that's what they don't want. That's really scary. And they need the organization to maintain and stay, so that they know what's going to go on. Like it's really just a programmatic, planned out world.
Yeah.
Like they want the world just planned out according to their rules. And would there be any freely developing change? That would be terrible.
Yeah.
And here's the thing: the incalculable is merely that which has not yet been mastered in calculation, but it will be.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the liberal approach. It's like, we understand that there are things outside liberalism, but we will get them and we will turn them into calculated, organized liberalism.
Yeah.
I don't know, to me that's really a...
Yeah. I'm curious to hear how you would sort of relate this to anxiety as a... Do you feel like it's speaking about that or not really?
I mean, anxiety is always present when you're talking about liberalism. And I would say in a sense that anxiety... So what you kind of get when you chart through this section one is that you start to feel not only the way liberalism is the establishment of mathematics in action and epistemological groundings and technology and machination and organization and rules and governing, and I mean all the words are in there.
Yeah.
But as you go through it, you realize that, well, like I brought up, is were one to start to try to dismantle all this,
right,
like is currently happening, The resistance to that takes on, as we see, tones of panic, rage, violence. We're seeing a lot of violence, right?
Yeah.
Why? Why is it's so? So there's no there's no sort of like, I don't know. There's not a lot of discourse. There's not a lot of like why this is important. It's actually just all about anxiety.
Yeah.
Because what they're experiencing is this that this fear of freely developing change from the ground up. Now, I also think so. That's kind of the obvious take on anxiety here.
Yeah.
But it also strikes me that, you know, as we absorb identity and liberalism into our cognitive structures, and as we're raised liberal, as we have been, and as we operate in a world in which liberalism is the only form of culture, cognition, psychology, all the sciences, all the soft sciences, all the humanities, all the literature, all the art, all the messaging, all the people, all the enlightenment, all the conversations, all the value judgments, all the assumptions, everything is liberalism, right?
Yeah.
All these things like rules and governing and organizations and the renunciation of freely developing change become our reified consciousness. But as he points out here, the incalculable is always out there.
Yeah, right.
On the liberalism wants to eat the world and absorb the world and control the world and encircle the world and have there be nothing outside it.
Yeah.
But somehow things always seem to pop up.
Yeah, right.
There always seems to be a Trump who kind of pops up. Right. Or all of a sudden there's this Tea Party movement, or all of a sudden there's like a bunch of Americans acting like psychopaths and wanting to like elect a nut job like Donald Trump. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it can't, in a, you know, I think bottom line is its goal for maximal democracy. Its objective of maximal democracy, which really just means fully liberalized democracy at the exclusion of any other perspective, which is the opposite of democracy, will always kind of fail.
Yeah.
Because it always generates its antithesis. And anxiety is the same way, you know? So I think anxiety triggers will always exist. But the degree to which you are clinging to the mathematical, technological epistemology of governing and planning and rules and calculability determines how triggering they actually are.
Right.
Now, I mean, that's a lot of words for just kind of like, yeah, but if you just chilled out, you know, I think it's hopefully a little profounder than that.
Yeah.
Because I think that, I mean, in a way, that's what we're doing with this podcast, is we're trying to really deep dive, really analyze, really find a lot of different vectors and holes.
Yeah.
And conduits and channels whereby liberalism, and there's billions, come to form consciousness.
Yeah.
Comes to form consciousness.
Yeah.
And consciousness can take many, many forms.
Yeah.
But the liberal formed consciousness is endemically anxious.
Yeah.
Because of the way, because of many of the things he says in this section.
Right.
And so the job is to really look profoundly and analytically and diversely into the many factors of how your mind and your expectations and your cultural experiences and your psychology are formed by these very biased, very you know, specific in their objectives kind of ideology.
Right. Yeah.
Liberalism is the formative disease that has handed us our current state of sickness.
Yeah.
And you have to figure out, and that continues to just kind of form us and inform mm-hmm. us and diffuse us and sicken us and limit us and form us and really doing the forensics, right?
Yeah.
Or what's the science of like how diseases happen? What's that? It's called
not epistemology, but epidemiology.
Epidemiology, yeah. Right? The epidemiology of consciousness, because
yeah.
liberalism is the disease that has generated a sick consciousness.
Yeah,
and that's what a lot of going on in this book. Anyhow,
yeah. you want to? Yeah, totally.
Do you want to read the next?
Should you do the next?
Sure.
Yeah. To speed of every sort, the mechanical increase in technical velocities, and such increase altogether only a consequence of the speed, the latter the inability to withstand in the stillness of concealed growth and of waiting, mania for the surprising, for what is again and again immediately and differently striking and enthralling, transience as the basic law of constancy, necessary, prompt forgetting and losing oneself in what comes next. On this basis, then, the erroneous representation of the high and the highest in the monstrous form of record-breaking performances, purely quantitative increase, blindness to the truly momentary, which is not the transient, but is what opens up eternity. With respect to speed, however, the eternal is the mere endurance of the same, the empty, and so on and on. The genuine unrest of the battle remains concealed, and in its place has stepped the restlessness of constantly more ingenious activity, which is pushed forward by the dread of becoming bored with oneself.
Okay. Wow. So he uses this word speed, and he's like, yeah, I mean mechanical velocity, technical velocity. I mean just going fast. And such increase altogether only a consequence of this speed. The consequence of this speed, the latter is the inability to withstand in the stillness of concealed growth and of waiting. Mm-hmm. So the faster things go, the harder it is to just sort of stand still and wait. Mania for the surprising, for what is again and again immediately and differently striking and enthralling. TikTok, I guess. Transience is the basic law of constancy. So we're constantly transient. It's important. What's necessary for all this, he says, is prompt forgetting and losing oneself in what comes next. TikTok. On this basis, then, the erroneous... And I say that with all reverence. On this basis, then, the erroneous representation of... So on this basis, then, the erroneous representation of the high and the highest in the monstrous form of record-breaking performances. All right. Yeah, purely quantitative increase, number of followers, blindness to the truly momentary, which is not the transient, but is what opens up eternity. Mm. Okay. So the momentary is what opens up eternity, not just a transient flyby minute, a second. With respect to speed, however, the eternal is the mere endurance of the same, the empty, and so on and on. So for speed... the eternal is just sameness, an on and on emptiness. The genuine unrest of the battle remains concealed. So the battle and the unrest of the battle is hidden, and in its place has stepped the restlessness of constantly more ingenious activity, constantly just more ingeniousness, which is pushed forward by the dread of becoming bored with oneself. Now that's the internet.
Yeah.
I mean,
scrolling.
Yeah, which is lovely. You know, I'm not going to diss scrolling, but Yeah, see, I would say, you know, just, like, you know, I'm going to say this, like, one really did seem about liberalism.
Yeah.
Two doesn't. I mean,
seems more about technology.
In the larger sense of liberalism, in the sense that Western society is liberal society, and all of these things are very indicative of Western society, liberal society, indicative of all societies, frankly. But, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure what to say about all that. I mean, I think we live in a time of speed. We live in a time of record-breaking performances. It's all, you know, and I think Heidegger is kind of saying, well, there are some things that are missed in that, through that. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean speed is bad, but I think that's important, not to think that Heidegger is just kind of saying all this is shallowness, oh, vanity of vanities. I think he's just saying that, you know, this is an aspect of the abandonment by being, and that there is more to it and more to life. And I think most people would agree with that. And we're in a very interesting time where people are addicted to speed, are addicted to everything in this thing, but they're also looking for other things. They're looking for the eternal and the momentary, right?
Yeah.
They're looking to fix this problem of constantly being bored with oneself. They're looking to find something deeper than a constant stream of ingenious activity. So it's all good.
Yeah. I feel like there's something with speed that, like, calculation makes speed possible, because if you've, in a way, already decided that these things are certain and something in particular, then you can just jump through it very quickly,
right,
without the need for stillness or thinking about it. So
no, that's a really interesting point. I mean, calculation is a grid of predictable and discernible points that are connected by formula, and the more things are calculated out, the quicker it is to go from point A to B to C, because in a way the channels have been developed, and calculation makes this, you know, speed a lot faster. And now, of course, you know, with AI assistance, with Grok, the new boyfriend, all calculations are right at your fingertips.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we all know, I mean, for those of us who can remember life before the internet, you know, it is interesting. I've noticed how less patient I am.
Yeah.
The idea of having something right away, getting an answer right away, doing something right away, responding right away, talking immediately with people, has gotten into a lot of other parts of my life. And, you know, I'm less patient there.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the challenge of the times, is that all this speed and calculation, how much do we want it to affect everything? You know, I had that experience, I think it was yesterday, with the trees.
Yeah.
Like, I just realized I'd kind of neglected my trees, and they weren't growing as well, and I knew that I had to kind of either throw a couple of them out and replace them, or kind of really dive in and fertilize and change the watering schedule and protect their roots and make some decisions and do some research. And, like, I knew there was, like, work ahead, and that's what I did all day. There's that work. But when I first realized it, I was so stressed and out.
Yeah, you were.
Because I felt like I needed to do it immediately or the trees would die, you know?
Yeah.
That was like speed and calculation taking over my emotional and sort of cognitive balance. And I was unable to wait. I felt like I just needed to do it all right away, which was silly because the trees have been fine generally. And the idea that I would do it in 36 hours.
Yeah.
But, you know, having everything at the click of your thumbs.
Yeah.
And you always feel you have to respond to someone immediately, Like, I will sit on texts, I will sit on calls, I will sit on emails a lot longer than you. But you, I know, you feel a great pressure. The minute something comes in, you have to respond right away.
Well, I have to say that since having kids, I feel like part of it is just because I don't want to forget. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it's taken on kind of a new level. But sure. But I would say, though, that prior to that, like, I definitely, and I was going to use the word urgency. Like, there's, like, an urgency to something once you think of it. And that's very, like, in the anxiety books, it's like if a thought carries sort of obscene urgency or, like, untoward urgency, then it's that and some other things, and it's likely to be an anxiety thought. So you're like, I have to deal with it now. I can't let it be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's such a problem.
Sure.
And, like, I mean, we get into this a little with, like posting content on socials. It's like, once we're like, oh, well, we should do this kind of content over here, it's like, okay, now we have to, like,
do it,
move it all, do it all right away, because if you keep posting the other way, it just feels like
Well, things move fast now.
I know.
And you really got to, like, keep up. And if you have an idea, you got to implement that idea immediately.
Yeah, or you lose track of it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, I guess I'm not, how much, like, does how fast technology work really affect how you think about it, like, with your trees? Or were you having maybe a little bit of anxiety for some reason about the trees or the cost of the yard or something that, like, brought that up?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just I don't know. There was an urgent. I mean, I think that, you know, I face a lot of problems and a lot of issues and solve things and do things on my phone. I work on my phone. I work on my computer. And it's all very fast and it's right at my fingers. And, like, I'm, you know, if there's something I need, I kind of get on and I do it. Uh-huh. But, like, with the trees, I did have this sensation that, like, well, if I'm going to address the tree issue, I've got to wake up tomorrow. I've got to go to the store. I've got to read some stuff. I've got to then go back and I've got to put the stuff into the trees. And then maybe it's not right. Then I got to go back to this. Like, the scale and the duration of that is so different than how I spend most of my time.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like, I wonder, like, I really, writing is an interesting thing, because I was a writer long before the internet, not long before the internet, but for a while before the internet. And now there's the internet, and it's hard to discern, but it is different. It is different. Like, it's harder to meditate. It's harder to get away. It's harder to feel lost in your mind. It's not saying anything new here. The internet and social media and the phone in your hand is a very immersive thing, and it's taken over the brain.
So
I don't know, it's slightly related, but today I was, now let's keep going.
Do we want to read more?
Next one's pretty long.
It is. It seems cool. I mean, we were talking about the massive.
Let's read it, and then it'll be the last one. I do have a couple of things to talk about.
Okay, great. 3, the burgeoning of the massive. This expression does not simply allude to the masses of society. Those masses have become prominent only because number already reigns, as does the calculable, i.e. what is accessible to everyone in the same way. What is common to the many and to all is what the many see as overarching. That accounts for the tendency to calculation and speed. Just as, conversely, these in turn place the massive in its tracks and in its framework. Here,
let me say really quick. I think it hadn't occurred to me, but I think I don't know what the German word is. I don't think I need to look it up. But I mean, the massive, I would imagine that that word is etymologically tied to the word for the masses.
Mm, yeah.
That so when he's talking about the massive, he's referencing also the emphasis in current sociological, political perspectives on the masses.
Interesting.
So go ahead.
Yeah. Here the most acute, because most inconspicuous, opposition to the rare and the unique, the essence of being. Everywhere in these ways of cloaking the abandonment by being, the distorted essence of beings in the guise of non-beings becomes more and more diffuse and indeed in the semblance of a great occurrence. The diffusion of these ways in which the abandonment by being is cloaked and indeed the diffusion of this abandonment itself are the strongest, because at first quite unnoticeably obstacle to the correct. Because at first quite unnoticeable obstacle to the correct assessment and grounding of the basic disposition of restraint, in which the essence of truth first shines forth in so far as the displacement into Dasein happens. Yet those modes of sojourning amid beings and the modes in which beings are dominated are so undermining because they do not allow themselves to be simply cleared away one day as apparently mere outer forms that enclose something inner. Those modes insert themselves in the place of the inner and ultimately deny the distinction between an inner and an outer, since they themselves claim to be the first and the only. To this corresponds the way knowledge is attained, as well as the calculated, speedy, massive dissemination to as many as possible in the shortest possible time, a bit of erudition that are not at all understood. Schooling, a word which in its current meaning turns the essence of school and leisure and of leisure upside down. Yet this too is only a new sign of the upheaval which does not halt the increasing uprootedness, because this upheaval does not reach the roots of beings, nor does it want to reach them, for it would have to encounter there its own groundlessness. To calculation, speed, and the massive, there comes to be allied something further which is related to all three and takes over in an emphatic way the disguising and cloaking of the inner disintegration. This is ... You'll have to tune in next
week. Exactly.
Next week.
I love that. I love that. Well done. Yeah, I mean, geez, okay. This expression, okay. The massive. So he's saying it's not just about the masses, because the idea of the masses is just a symptom of how the calculable and number have come to reign, i.e. what is accessible to everyone in the same way. What is common to the many and to all is what the many see as overarching. So, you know, I don't know. It's 2025. You don't have to explain any of this. I mean, it's just all about, you know, popular culture. What is common to the many and to all is that what the many see as overarching. That accounts for the tendency to calculation and speed, just as conversely, these in turn place the massive in its tracks and its frameworks. Yeah, the masses and calculation and speed are in a positive feedback loop with each other. Here, the most acute opposition to the rare and the unique. So, you know, yeah, the rare and the unique are opposed. They're considered not cool because they're not part of the masses. Everywhere in these ways of cloaking the abandonment of a being, the distorted essence of being in the guise of non-beings becomes more and more diffuse and indeed in the semblance of a great occurrence. Yeah. The cloaking of the abandonment of being, the distorted essence of beings, the guise of non-beings diffuses itself and seems like a great occurrence, but I don't think he thinks it is. The diffusion of these ways in which the abandonment by being is cloaked. So now I found this really interesting. I think it's exactly what I was just talking about. the diffusion of these ways in which the abandonment by being is cloaked. So really the infusion of calculation, speed, and the massive into everything we are and do, right?
Uh-huh.
And indeed, the diffusion of this abandonment itself are the strongest obstacle to the correct assessment and grounding of the basic disposition of restraint, in which the essence of truth first shines forth insofar as the displacement into docile habits. So it's just exactly what I was saying.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
It's but this is, he was writing in 1938.
Yeah, right.
And here he is describing internet brain. The internet makes restraint really hard.
Yeah.
Meditation, not looking at the internet, blah, blah, blah. Yet these, like those modes of sojourning amid beings and the modes in which beings are dominated are so undermining. So wait, yet those modes of sojourning amid beings.
I just want to say, so it, like, yeah, it's the internet, but it's also liberalism.
Tell me.
I'm not sure. I just said it without really thinking. But like, I guess for some reason, I'm having a little hard time just being like, oh yeah, it's the internet.
Yeah,
like, I get it. Like, I get it. But I mean, is there... I guess it is because if we think about the liberalism or I was saying earlier, the urgency or speed, like all these things, they feed together to be an obstacle to the correct assessment and grounding of restraint.
Yeah.
Because you just want an answer. There is an answer. Like like an answer comes to your mind immediately.
Yeah.
Like a word, an answer always comes to your mind. But then is that automatic, that really fast response, is there any truth there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's so not concealed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. That's sort of what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say I was listening to Victor David Hansen today, and I think the point he always pounds out is, for instance, in liberalism's response to what's happening to it right now, as it's slowly picked apart, is, it's just kind of screaming and yelling.
Yeah.
And yet what's markedly missing is our alternatives.
Yeah.
So Hansen like lists all these problems. He's like, Trump's trying to do this. Trump's trying to do this. Trump's trying to do this. This problem. So that's this problem. But yet nobody on the other side is offering alternative solutions.
Yeah.
They're just kind of screaming and yelling that things are supposed to stay exactly as they were. Yeah. And you're not supposed to think that things were bad.
Yeah, right.
And there's something there about calculation and speed and the organization and being opposed to restraint and I don't know, like it's almost like liberalism is so addicted to its calculations and the way it's set up its organizations that when those are challenged, it's not that they can really justify or explain what should happen instead. All they do is just clutch with great tenseness and fear and rage onto what was.
Yeah.
Right? Because they are afraid of restraint. They're afraid of the essence of truth. They're afraid of the change, right?
And they're afraid of anything outside of calculation.
Yeah.
Anything outside their calculation.
Yeah.
And they're not able to take this new calculation and like make it. Yeah.
Well, they're not even able to say, oh, well, let's see what happens.
Right, right.
For a year or two.
Right, right, right.
And if it doesn't work, we'll change it.
Yeah.
That's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
For them.
Yeah.
Let's go on.
Yeah.
Yet I'm a little confused by this. Those modes of sojourning amid beings. Oh, okay. So I think those modes of sojourning amid beings, which is calculation speed and the massive, those modes of sojourning amid beings and the modes in which beings are dominated, same modes, are so undermining because they do not allow themselves to be simply cleared away one day as apparently mere outer forms that enclose something inner. Those modes insert themselves in the place of the inner. So think about
this.
So in a sense, take modes of sojourning amid beings and use the word liberalism. Yet liberalism, which dominates beings, is undermining because it doesn't allow itself to be cleared away one day as some mere outer form, right?
Right.
That encloses something inner.
Yeah.
It has inserted itself in the place of the inner and ultimately denies the distinction between an inner and an outer.
Yes.
Since it itself claims to be the first and the only.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, so it's like instead of, let's say, democracy being at the inner and liberalism being at the outer.
Right, exactly.
It's claiming itself to be at the inner. And we say democracy in the non-maximalist sense.
That's right. That's exactly right. Very good analogy. To this corresponds the way knowledge is attained as well as the calculated, speedy, massive dissemination to as many as possible in the shortest possible time of bits of erudition that are not at all understood. I mean, he uses the word bits there.
Yeah.
So to this tendency for liberalism to claim that is it to move from being the outer to just being the inner, to this corresponds the way knowledge is attained. So liberalism controls the way knowledge is attained. And it is attained by through as well as the calculus being a massive system, knowledge is attained. To this corresponds the way knowledge is attained to as many as possible in the shortest possible time. So yeah. Provided to as many of bits of erudition that are not at all understood. I mean, that's it. Schooling. Everyone is schooled. No, yeah, everyone's schooled. Yeah. School. And being schooled, being going to school, has become the insignia of liberalism.
Yeah.
That everyone has bits of erudition. And everyone knows what's best. And this schooling, a word which in its current meaning turns the essence of school and of leisure upside down. meaning school becomes leisure. And leisure becomes schooling. The leisureful are the schooled, and the leisureful school people.
Yeah.
In other words, they don't really do anything. They're just schooled. And so they run around schooling everyone.
Yeah.
Yet this too is only a new sign of the upheaval which does not halt the increasing uprootedness, because this upheaval does not reach the roots of beings, nor does it want to reach them, for it would have to encounter there its own groundlessness.
Yeah.
Yeah. To calculation speed and the massive, and then we get to the cliffhanger. Yeah. Very interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Very interesting stuff. I mean, one of the things I want to talk about, which I think kind of relates to this, is the citizen versus the non-citizen, which we've been talking about, and it's been a hot topic this week. And I would say liberalism's refusal, really patent, enraged refusal, almost even like self-deluding refusal, to distinguish the citizen from the non-citizen. We've seen it in Mahmoud Khalil and the attempt to deport people with green cards who are not citizens because they seem violent and have actually broken laws. And liberalism jumps in and attempts to claim that those people deserve the same protections and rights as citizens.
Right.
So they immediately refused to distinguish between citizens and non-citizens.
Right.
We see it in, you know, Trump sending a plane full of Venezuelan thugs and criminals, gang members who are illegal immigrants, and a judge stopping him and saying those people need due process, which is only something granted citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Non-citizens don't have a right to due process in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, liberalism just occludes and ignores citizen from non-citizen. And of course, immigrant and illegal immigrant,
right.
Two completely different things. Again, as different as guest and intruder in your house.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody would say a guest and an intruder are the same thing, but yeah. Liberalism does actually. And so,
or like, what is it that was the WS dot text, like a real text and a spam text? Those are also.
Oh yeah, exactly. And so I think that there's something in there about, well, it's a little about the outer, assuming it is now
the
inner.
Yeah.
It's a little bit about minimalist versus maximalist democracy. It's a little bit about stop interrupting our calculations, stop interrupting our speed, stop delimiting our massive. So for instance, the liberals want the illegal immigrants and the non-citizens to be a part of the masses.
Yeah.
Because they're driven to increase the masses, because they think the more masses there are, the more of those masses will vote for them and keep them in power. And their kind of suicidal empathy or their charitable nature needs to constantly ascribe the rights of the masses to more and more people, because that's sort of how their cancer grows.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
And as Molly Hemingway said on the podcast that, you know, the law recognizes classes of people.
Yeah.
There are different classes of people. And it's interesting when you hear that word class. Yeah. Liberals hate class.
Yeah.
They hate classes. But there are classes of people. There's, you know, for instance,
like categorization.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and most importantly, there are classes of people when it comes to rights.
Yeah.
So for instance, you know, the people who are camping all over the washes and rivers and streets of Tucson are a different class of people than the people who own property along those washes.
Or the people camping in BLM areas.
Or the people camping in BLM areas. Or, you know, your context defines your class, and your class defines your rights.
Mm-hmm.
Liberalism wants all people to have all the rights.
Right, which is
regardless of class.
Says here that there's no distinction between inner and outer, since basically they claim to be the one and only.
Well,
so
yeah,
it's basically saying that there's no distinction in class. It's just everyone's the same.
There's no distinction between inner and outer. And what a better way to describe liberal immigration policy?
Yeah,
or open borders.
Yeah,
or the right to camp in washes and rivers.
Yeah,
in the middle of a city. Like the outer are now inner, like the outer, like literally the outer, meaning, you know, sort of the homeless now have like the best camping spot in the city. Like, look at them sitting there. They're in the wash. Whole Foods is like, you know, 100 yards away. They've got a park. They're camping amid trees. It's beautiful. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like now they're the inner.
Yeah,
and they've just insinuated themselves into the inner sanctum of the city, because liberalism is an insidious covert invasion of everything.
Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't recognize borders. It doesn't respect borders. It doesn't respect property. It doesn't respect limits. It doesn't respect the law. It just wants everything everywhere, because the more stuff is broken down, the more you need liberalism to educate you and school you and give take your money and give it to you back at an interest rate, and to tax you to pay for other things. It's just a method of control and complete indoctrination and intrusion.
And I think there's like a sort of a like you were saying, maybe it's like a feeling. I'm not sure what it is where someone's like, oh, well, I have these rights, so I want everyone to have these rights.
Yes.
So I want to say it comes from a good-hearted place, but I'm not really sure that's good-hearted because it's just bad logic, actually.
Right.
And false logic and projection logic, or I don't know if logic's the right word, but I just think, like I feel like so often it's sort of, I feel like so often we're like, well, but you know, the root desire is good or something, but actually I don't think the root desire is good. I think it's actually at this point, like, well, it's nihilism.
It is.
Or it's nasty. I don't know.
It's destruction.
Yeah, it's like you were saying, the violence and everything. Yeah.
Well, and it's the desire to destroy. I mean, motivating liberalism is the desire to destroy
because
America.
Yeah, and it's and it's leisure, because people who are saying that are in a spot of leisure.
Yes.
So they're saying, okay, so I want this other person to experience the rights I have, but that doesn't take into account that there are like lots of people who don't have those, who are in between there, who aren't getting those rights either,
right,
but who should get it. So maybe that's where, yeah, the leisure comes in.
Yeah.
I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that rights are apportioned according to context and situation and class and status, is offensive to liberalism. It's offensive to liberalism. Because
it's systemic racism or something.
Yeah. But I would say even more that with this thing Heidegger brings up with the outer and the inner.
Yeah.
Like when those borders and boundaries and limits and classes and rules and contexts and are in place, liberalism can't move from the outer to the inner.
Mm, right.
And its goal is to always get more into the inner. And the reason it wants to be in the inner is because it wants to control and manipulate for its own reasons.
Yeah.
It uses a veneer of empathy and altruism.
Right.
But really what it wants is control.
Yeah, that's true.
And why does it want control? Well, it likes power, it likes money, everybody does, but it's also anxious.
Mm, right.
If there's an inner, then the inner might make choices.
Right.
And that makes liberalism really anxious. Because liberalism is not interested. Maximalist democracy is anti-democracy.
Yeah. Do you want to explain maximalist? Because we haven't talked about
that. So we talked about it quite a few episodes ago. So in democracy, political scientists talk about democracy in two ways, minimalist and maximalist. And as I pointed out in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy under the entry democracy, they start by saying there's minimalist democracy and maximalist democracy, but we're only going to talk about maximalist democracy. And they continue to make a gigantic encyclopedic passage. What's the phrase?
Entry,
exactly. On maximalist democracy. So minimalist democracy, a theory of the democracy that's minimalist, is that there are a set number of kind of institutional arrangements, institutions and institutional arrangements that are necessary for democracy, for a form of government to be called democracy. And if you have those institutional arrangements in place, and again, there are things like guaranteed voting, some checks and balances, laws that are predictable and executable. Then you have democracy, and that's mm-hmm. that's it. And then what that democracy becomes outside of that, in terms of the policies, the way the society runs, the actual laws are, as opposed to just that there is law that is predictable. That's all to be decided by the democracy. That's minimalist democracy. Maximalist democracy gets to the idea that there are a lot of guaranteed rights and policy decisions
Moralism.
Forms of bureaucratic behavior, moral choices, the government behaving in certain ways that are signs that you have a democracy. And when you look at all those things, they're actually just all basically liberal talking points.
Yeah. Maximalist democracy is liberalism, and it's not democracy.
Well, it's inherently anti-democracy because maximalist democracy is
massive.
is claiming that to be democracy, you have to be liberal democracy.
Yes. I feel like it might relate to massive, the word massive.
Yeah, maybe. And which basically, and as we've seen this writ large in the last 12 years, basically claims that anything that is not liberal democracy is not democracy, which right. is why our democracy is at risk.
Right, right.
That's why liberals say that.
Because maximalist democracy
is What they mean is liberal maximalist democracy right. is at risk.
Right.
Because they can't imagine democracy outside of that.
Yeah.
Which is obviously to any thinking person a total joke.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I don't think anyone who is currently a liberal is actually can yeah. claim to be a thinking person. I don't yeah. think they can
yeah.
anymore.
Yeah.
I think they're just ideological people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They're not thinking in the sense that they don't see the inherent logical flaws in their own position.
Mm-hmm.
Their basic point is that my position is justified by my position.
Yeah. And they seem incapable of considering that people have other ideas.
Well, they know that people have other ideas. They seem incapable of feeling that those ideas deserve a place in the world.
Yeah.
Or exactly. that the system should allow a place for those ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those ideas are inimical to everything.
Mm-hmm.
They're outside. They're incalculable. What does he say? He says, freely, what is that? Freely changing from the ground up, he says.
Mm.
The freely developing change from the ground up, that they're not interested in.
Yeah.
You know, we have an example today. The Department of Education is being eradicated. Trump comes out with a statement that says we're gonna put power back into the states and the communities and the parents. We don't feel that the federal control of education has been successful. The evidence is that our educational results have been going straight downhill since the Department of Education started. So you have a very clear kind of like, well, gosh, what's the reality? The reality is you can map the beginning of the Department of Education with the downfall of American education. So are they related? I don't know, but they seem to be, or maybe they're not. But the point is Trump is like, we're going to try it a different way.
Yeah.
Now, I honestly have no idea. I'm not an expert on education policy. I have no idea if what he's saying is a good idea or not.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah.
Why am I for it? Because what we've been doing is not working.
Yeah.
And liberalism's position is we should keep doing what we've been doing.
Because we're like still alive.
Because it's liberal.
Let's just keep
alive. Exactly. Because we're breathing.
Yeah.
But it hasn't worked. So we need to try something different.
Right, right.
Liberals don't have an alternative.
Right.
They just want to keep doing exactly what they've been doing.
Yeah.
Trump's put forward an alternative. It might not work. But guess what? What we're doing isn't working either.
Yeah. Yeah.
So holding to what's been going on because it sucks, even though it sucks, is not a way. Same thing with Ukraine, same thing with immigration, same thing with the national debt, same thing with crime. Everything.
Yeah. Totally.
So I don't even know if I agree with any of Trump's policies. It's not even really about that. It's actually just saying, you know, we just need somebody to try something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just give it a try. And liberalism, of course, wants to wage war against that.
Right, right. I want to hear more about this idea that, like you were saying, liberalism wants control, wants to be the first and only. And then you said that it wants to control because it's anxious. And I think, like, also, yes, of course, the power and the winning and all that, like, absolute power corrupts absolutely, et cetera. But I'd like to hear more about how that is. Why? I mean, I guess it's, I don't know. Talk more about why liberalism. Why the anxiety at the heart of liberalism?
Well, it's a good question. But I think that, you know, what actually, if you read something like The Conservative Mind, by Russell Kirk, I think that's his name, the classic kind of history of conservatism, you see that it's not that liberals are anxious or. Well, when they are, but what is this political division? What are these political channels that are running alongside each other?
Yeah.
Conservatism and liberalism, conservatism. And they've been running alongside each other for like 500 years, 400 years. They are the modern world. What are they? And what this book makes clear is that which came first, liberalism or anxiety? And the answer is anxiety.
Mm.
So liberalism is the politics of the anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And conservatism is the politics, I would say, of the stoic.
Mm.
That would probably be the best word for it.
Mm-hmm.
The Stoic essentially try to establish a system whereby, and you know, I'm not talking about all conservatism here. In a sense, I'm talking a little bit about this new conservatism that we're facing right now. The Stoic it's a little bit parallel to equality versus equity, and the way they talk about that now. The Stoic covets a system whereby freedom can occur.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't quite know what's going to occur then, but you know that freedom is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Liberalism, being so anxious, wants a planned, controlled system. So mm-hmm. liberalism is a political solution to anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatism mm-hmm. is, in a sense, a political implementation of Stoicism.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's well said.
And, you know, the Stoic can be anxious, and the anxious can be Stoic. It's probably not as clear. And there, of course, are anxieties at the heart of conservatism as well. But I think in general, it works.
Yeah.
I think that these emotions of anxiety or Stoicism, and maybe Stoicism isn't right, maybe just... raw power. I think conservatives are more eager to have a world in which competition and games of power and games of risk and games of intelligence and games of strategy and combat are allowed to play out, because they want those games. They think they can win those games, and they like a world in which those games are how things are decided.
Yeah.
Whereas liberals, those things make liberals really anxious. They don't want that. So what they want is, controlled planning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
So, but I think we tend to run around saying things like liberals are so blank and conservatives are so blank and liberals are so blank, but actually it's the other way around. The emotions make the ideology.
Right.
The disposition, like Heidegger would say, the dispositions determine the cognitions.
Right.
The dispositions determine the policies and the approaches and the obsessions and the fixations and the formations.
Yeah.
Liberalism is a massive attempt to negate anxiety in every form.
Yeah.
That's why it is so fixated on destroying its opposition.
Yeah.
Making everything under its control and making everything calculated and planned out.
Yeah.
That is, if you've ever known somebody who lives like that and thinks like that, they're doing that because they're anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're scared.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It's well said. Yeah.
Anyhow, I think that's enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was really interesting. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful.
I feel like we talked about some new things.
So I feel like exciting. We did. Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful section. I'm excited
for the rest.
I'm hanging off the cliff. I'm just like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Okay, good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.